would like to introduce our speaker, Professor Yücel Yanıkdağ. He's an associate professor of Ottoman Islamic history at the University of Richmond in Virginia. Recently a member of, at the Institute of Advanced Studies, he has twice been awarded Fulbright Hayes Fellowships. He recently published Healing the Nation, Prisoners of War, Medicine and Nationalism in Turkey, 1914 to 1939, which was published by Edinburgh Press, Edinburgh University Press in 2013, which explores identity and nationalism among Ottoman prisoners of war and the Ottoman Turkish psychiatrists to examine them upon their return. He is currently working on a history of Ottoman soldiers' traumatic experience in the Great War. Please help me welcome Professor Yanıkdağ.
Thank you. Well, thank you for inviting me, Mustafa, and thank you, all of you, for being here. So I will be talking about what I call between sacrifice and self-preservation, Ottoman notions of soldier motivation and manliness during the Great War. I have a map here, and I will be mentioning a couple of places on this map. Not that we need to know it, but it seems to be important to the few people that I mentioned in my talk. One is Erzurum, which is right there. I know it's difficult to see. I'm going to mention Gallipoli, which was the Battle of Gallipoli right around here. And well, I don't know if I mentioned Mersin, but Mersin is right here. Konya is unfortunately not marked, but right above the O there is the fourth place that I will mention. On November 27, 1915, taking advantage of a brief quiet in his own trench sector in Gallipoli, Lieutenant Mehmet Fassi decided to visit his officer friend Agati, who was likely a Syrian Arab, in a nearby sector. He found Agati deeply distressed because of the previous night's attempt to probe into enemy trenches had been a complete failure. Men were selected for the mission, but when it was time to move into the no man's land, some hesitated. Mehmet Fassi reported, quote, "Though they were prodded, they prodded the men with bayonets, some of them refused to emerge from the trench and even started to cry like women," end quote. Agati was told to try it again that night. While Mehmet Fassi was still at Agati's place, Agati ordered his sergeants to select 40 men and have one sergeant lead them that night. Sometime later, one of the sergeants came back into Agati's dugout. Dugout is basically an underground trench where somebody either can lie down or sleep, but it's not wide at all. So you're basically at least three sides, but possibly more covered by dirt. So you're basically underground. So one of the sergeants came into Agati's dugout and to announce that they were able to pick 40 men, but no sergeant, including himself, volunteered for the mission. Seeing that Agati was just as unnerved as his men, Mehmet Fassi intervened on his behalf, and he wrote in his diary, quote, "I asked the sergeant how many times he's been called under arms. 6 times," was the reply. "I told him that he has not yet been killed because the time decreed by his fate for his death has not come. Surely this means that his father's spirit was watching over him. I asked him how he will be able to face woman folk if he returns with the reputation of a coward. I told him that if they continue to behave similarly, I would make a point of exposing them to everyone in our hometown of Mersin." That's the place in the south. In order to manage the sergeant's fear and motivate him, Mehmet Fassi appealed to three notions. The first was, actually, I think I overdid my slide. The first was a sense of fatalism, or in Arabic, tevekkül in Turkish. Also encountered among European soldiers, this was the idea that if a bullet carried one's name on it, there was no way of escaping it. Second is the notion that the sergeant's warrior ancestors were both watching over and judging him. His father and ancestors became the symbol of bravery and manliness. And finally, the suggestion that he was not only failing to defend the women folk, as was his manly duty, but also acting cowardly given his unwillingness to volunteer that night and crying like woman the previous night. Mehmet Fassi was trying to motivate him, both by reminding him that he would die only if his time came, and by invoking the concept of manliness, which was understood as the opposite of cowardliness. About 2 years later, another young officer, Shevket Süreya, who's pictured there in the corner, was having some difficulties with his men as well. A convinced nationalist himself, he was frustrated with his men because reportedly they did not know whether they were fighting to defend their religion, their land, nation, or something else. His views were shared by Hussein Hakkı, an officer who produced manuals on how to motivate the men and, in fact, had an even lower opinion of the soldiers' worldview. Quote, Hussein Hakkı said, "These poor fellows, when necessary, give up their lives for the protection of their honor." The word here is namus, and I will come back to this. "But they do not understand what it is they really die for. For them, fatherland consists of their own fields and the nation of their village," end quote. My talk is small part of a larger work in progress on a social and cultural history of the Ottoman Great War, which focuses largely on the soldiers' experiences, emotions, and traumas. This evening, as part of a question of what motivated the men to fight, I will explore the themes referenced by Mehmet Fassi. These are the notions of sacrifice, tavakkul or fatalism, manliness, and the role of fear among soldiers in making and unmaking them as men. For part of my talk, I rely on what I call motivational literature, and these are some examples of them. Booklets produced generally by officers or sometimes even by men of religion for the purpose of mentally training, militarizing, and nationalizing the men. These works attempted to imbue them with some new and modern concepts and firm up others already familiar so that the threat of violence was not the only factor keeping the men at the front. One of the overarching concepts was sacrifice. Men were told that if the need came up, they must be willing to sacrifice themselves in the defense of their fatherland, nation, religion, and the protection of their families, namely their womenfolk. Before going on any further, I should note a couple of things about the Ottoman Empire at this point. The rate of literacy in the empire was between 5% and 7%, obviously very low. The illiterate peasant soldiers could not write down their thoughts, but the literate young officers, sometimes I call them subalterns, just British influence here, young men who became career or reserve officers did leave behind significant sources, which I use here. The motivational literature I mentioned above was delivered as lectures to the illiterate soldiers as conditions and time allowed during both peace and wartime. Both the manual authors and the officers in charge of training believed in the larger utility of the motivational lessons well beyond military service. Influenced by German General von der Goltz and his book Nation in Arms, Ottoman officers came to view the military as the nation's common classroom. This is their phrase. As men were called to arms, officers would not only impart them with motivation for battle, but also nationalize them through education on their nation, empire, history, religion, and even proper behavior. Therefore, when they lectured them on motivation, cowardice as the opposite of manliness, or on their nation, the intention was to create new subjects through education and discipline. The men were introduced to modern concepts of nationalism, national identity, and civic duty. However, the military authorities also took advantage of the kinds of traditional religious and patriarchal beliefs already present among the men to motivate them for warfare. In other words, Ottoman military training attempted to modernize the men without directly rejecting traditional sources of motivation and identity. because the whole nation was in need of the same ideals, they thought, what successive waves of soldiers learned, they could teach their families who did not have the benefit of this nation's common classroom. Seen in this limited way, compulsory military service indeed became a school for the peasant soldiers. In the Ottoman military, soldiers were referred to as efrad, the plural form of the Arabic word for individual, therefore individuals. Thus, in the Ottoman context, Ottoman efrad meant both soldiers and individuals. This dual meaning helped one manual writer demonstrate the long-term aim of the instructions with a play on words. According to him, proper moral and social preparation during military service would assure that first individuals of the military and eventually individuals of the nation would come to possess common ideals and causes. The easy switch from soldiers to individuals of the nation was meant to evoke the notion of military nation as proposed by von der Goltz. For them, in practical terms, this meant that in time of need, every individual was a soldier. Or put differently, in the writer's own words, quote, "There is no difference between those who perform their duty and those who are always ready to perform it," end quote. If the myth that Turks were a military nation found its fuller development in the 1930s, its origins can be traced to the late empire. Especially during times of war, the Ottoman military made extensive use of the notion of sacrifice, which we might define as a set of concepts commanding the virtue of laying down one's life for a greater cause beyond the individual. Also employed in Europe, such a notion represented the act of dying for a greater cause as a sacred undertaking. What they wanted or did not want to sacrifice themselves for might have changed from England and France to the Ottoman Empire, but the notion of sacrifice seems to be remarkably similar. Before we look at what these greater causes were for the Ottomans, I should explain how such notions were communicated to the men. The most common instructional method required soldiers' active cooperation by providing memorized answers to brief questions asked by the officers. Similar to other forms of learning by repetition, these questions were designed to elicit standard, or what I call canned responses. Nearly all manuals noted that lessons offered and questions asked to the men should be short and simple and in the plainest language possible for them to understand it. Grand ideas had to be simplified in question-answer fashion to increase the chances of imitation and suggestion through repetition. Not surprisingly, all works about motivation in war give significant attention to religion. Recognizing the military utility of a non-military Islamic religious concept, most point out the special importance of tawakkul, or putting one's trust and depending upon God. We witnessed this earlier when Mehmet Fasih tried to motivate the sergeant. One manual writer asked, quote, "Isn't tawakkul the most respectable and courageous consolation for members of the military who suffer from various forms of deprivation, misery, and dreadful disasters during times of war?" End quote. Seeing disasters as part of God's plan was meant to offer a sense of consolation because tomorrow might bring something different, and any attempt to change it would be a resistance against God's will. The same person continued, quote, "When human beings find themselves in a dangerous situation, they always think of death and mortality. As the moment of death is unknown, they have no choice but to completely surrender to this mysterious power," end quote. The key to tawakkul then was the notion of surrender or resignation and being safe through acceptance of God's will. In order to overcome the fear of suffering and death, the soldier needed to resign himself to this will of God by trusting him. This would ideally lead to a state of tranquility through acceptance of destiny. Promoting tawakkul offered some hope to soldiers, for instead of believing that death was inescapable, they could also feel some hope that they would only die if God determined that it should be so. And since there was nothing they could do to alter their fate, soldiers would not run away, but stand their ground, or so it was believed. Many officers appreciate the military utility of tawakkul in times of war among the soldiers, but some noted its possible hazards beyond military service. They believed that religious notions like tawakkul were misinterpreted and abused by minimally educated village imams, these are prayer leaders, to promote further fatalism and otherworldliness. This is the idea that, you live for the life thereafter rather than your life on this world among the peasants. Otherworldly thinking, the officers thought, undermined what should be the peasants' more natural desire to work for material progress to improve their lives and the fatherland for which they were asked to sacrifice themselves. Manual writers and subaltern officers firmly believed in the usefulness of history lessons for motivating the peasant soldiers as well. Featuring stories of noteworthy Ottoman military feats, these stories emphasize the bravery of Ottomans from the highest to the lowest ranks. Highlighting the said bravery or achievements of the likes of Suleiman the Magnificent had been the norm, but since the late 19th century, lionization of ordinary men as martyrs for fatherland and Islam was especially on the rise. The Battle of Gallipoli alone produced a number of such examples. Sergeant Mehmed, for example, who held of a large enemy force with only a few dozen men, long enough for reinforcements to arrive, is the most famous of these. Sergeant Mehmed, who died along with all of his men, nearly I should say, was the son of a certain Sergeant Veli, who had distinguished himself in the Balkan Wars. So you see the genealogy here. Presumably, glorification of ordinary men made it possible for the listener to imagine himself in the same role. As one officer put it, such stories needed to demonstrate the wonderful qualities, wonderful qualities of our conquering might, courageousness, and bravery, end quote, by appealing to the tastes of and exciting the spirits of soldiers. Historical stories also reminded the men that, quote, every corner of the fatherland had been soaked by the blood of their ancestors, end quote. Acting cowardly or failing to defend these same lands would offend the sacrifices of these past martyrs, as we saw with Mehmet Fassi's, when Mehmet Fassi reminded Agati's sergeant about his father's spirit. As the following brief example of an answer question lesson demonstrates, the duty to defend the fatherland was presented as an obligation with religious connotations owed to the state, the nation, martyred ancestors, and even future generations. So this is a question from one of these manuals. Quote, what is necessary to eat halal bread? You guys know halal, obviously. So this question had, but the answer had nothing to do with living an honest or ethical life as it would be in another context. Soldiers were to respond, this is the canned response, obviously, quote, one must serve the fatherland with utmost loyalty, end quote. Another question followed, quote, what happens to those who do not eat halal bread, end quote. Suddenly, the answer involved both the soldier and his children, for such a person would be considered a scoundrel, a thief, a degenerate, and his children would be good-for-nothing base characters, end quote. The next question provided a way out from having such children. Quote again, who are the most precious and important children of the village, end quote. Of course, this is the response again, quote, children of wounded warriors, grandchildren of martyrs, especially if they have martyrs in their family for a few generations, end quote. Although reminding the front soldier about his children might not have seemed like the best idea, it was also an opportunity to put them at ease about leaving family members behind. The next question asked, quote, who would take care of a martyr's orphans, end quote. And the answer noted that a martyr's children would not be considered orphans at all because the whole nation would adopt them. That is, they would be the nation's children, the nation the soldier reportedly did not even know upon enlistment, according to many officers. These manuals also attempted to impart sentiments of stoic endurance, suppression of sentiment, and forbearance of pain and hardship. One of these works, called The Nation and Military, I guess we changed that slide already, suggested proper behavior through imitation. And this is a block quotation again. Stoic and enduring soldiers won't get confused during most bloody and most dim times of warfare. Such soldiers would say, martyrdom is fame, being wounded is dignity, and not lose their fortitude. They would not turn away from the enemy. These temperaments are like a citadel that will never collapse, end quote. Ideas of this ideas in this type of literature were derived from the thoughts of military officials and men of religion. And as such, they're about ideology and expectations rather than experience. In other words, these normative statements did not determine behavior, and expectations expressed in them should not be taken for evidence of subjectivity. Now, by turning to first-person narratives, I will take a look at sacrifice, tawakkul, and fear to see how they were experienced and reflected in the self-perceptions of the men. I mentioned that officers delivered lessons in the manuals to the soldiers. Unfortunately, given the lack of literacy among the peasant soldiers, it's nearly impossible to consider the reception of the lessons directly from their perspective. However, we are lucky enough to have at least one memoir of an enlisted man who wrote about these very issues. Supplementing this with diaries, memoirs of officers, essays, and poems appearing in troop newspapers, we can give a relatively good profile of the enlisted men's experience. Admittedly, the concerned memoir was not written by an average soldier who could barely read and write, but by a high madrasa graduate, whose name was Abdullah Fevzi, from the town of Konya in central Anatolia. Abdullah Fevzi didn't mention that he was highly educated. He was educated in religion, but educated nevertheless. Therefore, he was conscripted as an enlisted man to serve in Gallipoli. Written during the interwar period, but published posthumously in 2011, Abdullah Fevzi has a political agenda as well in his memoir. He was highly critical of the wartime government for bringing in what he calls anti-religionism to the empire. In any case, because he initially did not mention his education, Abdullah Efendi served as an enlisted man. But at some point, the life of a front soldier proved too difficult for him, and he ended up notifying his commanding officer of his religious and educational qualifications, and he was made the battalion imam, or prayer leader. So he was supposed to give moral support to the men who were fighting. Abdullah Fevzi disagreed with how his own officer attempted to motivate soldiers. He thought that because the limited horizons of the illiterate soldiers, asking them to defend the fatherland was not an effective motivation. He was sure that the idea of fatherland was simply too abstract for the illiterate soldiers. Because he believed that the soldiers regionally identified themselves, we saw this earlier, they could not imagine all parts of the empire were part of the fatherland in the larger sense. Put differently, a soldier from eastern Anatolia could not understand what a loss in Gallipoli would mean for him personally. The fatherland was behind the soldier, he said, but the likely death was in front of him. Observing that soldiers became, quote, as quiet as an out-of-steam train, end quote, prior to an attack, he suggested that secular notions were not enough on their own to calm fears and motivate the men to charge into enemy trenches. He noted when soldiers realized that they might not see their families again, they prayed and asked God to spare their lives for the sake of their children. This was an indication for him that mention of fatherland and families had been distractions. Therefore, he speculated that at such crucial moments, love for the fatherland would not encourage the men to charge into enemy trenches, but only convince him to desert. What did Abdullah Fevzi suggest instead? He proposed that references to fatherland should be avoided altogether, and men should be told that they were fighting for the defense of Islam and that God's blessings awaited them in paradise in case of martyrdom. In other words, everything needed to be focused on the defense of Islam rather than on more modern concepts like the nation. We have to consider a few things as we weigh Abdullah Fevzi's observations. We're all soldiers in Gallipoli, because that's where he was, named Abdullah Mehmed or Mustafa, or were there also non-Muslim Ottomans with names like Yanis, Bedros, or Isak? Of course there were, though not very many in the front lines. Could it be that specifically Islamic themes were toned down and the fatherland was highlighted when a unit was not exclusively composed of non-Muslim soldiers? For example, Captain Sokrat Efendi, a Greek Orthodox Ottoman, wrote that in Gallipoli he tried to motivate his troops by talking to them about his experiences in the Balkan Wars, so that tells us he already fought there, their families that they left behind, and the urgency of pushing the enemy into the sea to rescue the fatherland. Sokrat Efendi likely avoided religious themes for obvious reasons. Still, we should not take Sokrat Efendi's non-Muslimness and Abdullah Fevzi's officers' reported secularism as typical of why some officers might have downplayed or avoided religious themes in motivating the men. Can we confirm or challenge what Abdullah Fevzi says in other ways? Luckily, we have Mustafa Fevzi, also from the town of Konya, who was also stationed in Gallipoli. Though he too was a madrasa graduate, he was of a slightly different type in temperament when compared to Mustafa Fevzi Efendi. Having mentioned that he was educated, Mustafa Fevzi was put in charge of a unit of men as a sergeant major, so that was his rank. He sometimes wrote in the first person plural to describe the emotions in his unit. While religious notions are not absent from his memoir, Mustafa Fevzi clearly preferred to highlight the defense of the fatherland as the motivation for fighting the war. Almost as if to answer Abdullah Fevzi's observations that a soldier from the East would not know what a loss in Gallipoli would mean, Mustafa Fevzi wrote, quote, "We all knew we were there at the main gate of our fatherland. A loss here meant the loss of Istanbul. Because of this, we continually charged the enemy," end quote. Perhaps Istanbul, I should add here, the capital city of the Ottoman Empire. Perhaps the peasant soldiers could identify with the capital city of Istanbul if they could not identify with Gallipoli. We met Lieutenant Mehmet Fasi earlier, hailing from the town of Mersin in southern Anatolia. He made similar observations. Saddened by the death of a soldier named Nuri, Mehmet Fasi noted that he should not have died because he had no business in the front trenches. Normally stationed in the rear lines, Nuri showed up daily to help repair trenches that suffered because of bombardment during the night. At the burial, under an olive tree, a shaky-voiced Mehmet Fasi mentioned that Nuri came from the town of Erzurum in the east to fight in Gallipoli. Before he could finish his tribute, Mehmet Fasi started to cry. Just then, he noticed that all men present were wiping their tears. These were, however, manly tears, not out of fear, but for the loss of a worthy comrade who had made the ultimate sacrifice. Right then, a close friend of Nuri leaned over to Mehmet Fasi and said, quote, "We're both from Erzurum. On the way, Nuri told me that he had hoped to become a martyr," end quote. We do not know whether Nuri thought that he was defending the nation, homeland, or Islam, or all of them, but he seemed to have made the connection between sacrifice on the one hand and Erzurum and Gallipoli on the other. Of course, it is possible that not everyone understood or internalized the lessons about sacrifice and fatherland. But for those who did, these sentiments stayed with them for a long time. Evidence left by Ottoman prisoners of war indicates the appeal of those messages. For example, the following poem by a prisoner of war in British captivity, by the way, written in one of these camp newspapers in 1920, brings together all the motivational themes that I mentioned earlier. He wrote, "When the battlefield was aflame, bayonets and lances were raised above," meaning they're ready to attack. "Sounds of repeated phrases affirming the greatness and unity of God rose to the divine throne. Suddenly, those who were sad and hopeless became joyful again. Desire for paradise entered the soldier's soul. Osman, like a hot burning fire, yelled out from his trench, sounding like an exploding cannon. When the fatherland is being attacked, I cannot stand still. My father's soul, I'm sure, looks down on me, for I'm the son of a martyr. I cannot change my faith." It's all here. Cries of God's name during a bayonet attack, fatherland, the martyred ancestors. While Abdullah Fevzi may have complained about the absence of religious themes at the front, motivational literature, other memoirs, letters written by commanding officers to parents of dead soldiers, and troop newspapers tell us a slightly different story. However, we have to also keep in mind the nature of the sources. Pieces written by other people's eyes were less likely to be candid about these kinds of issues. A troop newspaper, a letter to a dead soldier's father, was not inclined to point out the dissenters among the crowd of the willing. Surely, some men found no glory in dying for the fatherland or religion. These notions were not simply convincing enough for some to overcome their fear of death. As Abdullah Fevzi pointed out, instances of men praying to see their families indicates their desire to live. Mehmet Fassi himself frequently worried about the future. No one would have called him a coward, for he was wounded twice in action and fought on a few different fronts after Gallipoli. While accepting the chances of death, he desperately wanted to survive to start a family. At the opening of my talk, I mentioned that Mehmet Fassi scolded Gatti's sergeant. He reminded the sergeant of Tavakkul and of his ancestors watching over and judging him. Was he able to motivate the sergeant? The way he recorded in his diary, or the way he completed this entry, indicates that it probably was not the case. After Mehmet Fassi's short speech, the sergeant walked out of the dugout without saying a word. This is what Mehmet Fassi says. "I interpret this to mean that he was made to realize that there was no other option, given that he could also face court martials for cowardice. He just decided to accept his fate, basically." I would like to turn now to Mehmet Fassi's last effort to motivate the sergeant by threatening to expose him as a coward before the women folk at home. What did he mean exactly by this? Scholars of the Great War in Europe have suggested that identities men gained through war experience were implicitly gendering, for war was a sphere of masculine attainment. In the case of the Ottoman Empire, even the later Turkish Republic, military service, even without war experience, was explicitly gendering. For military service was constructed as a rite of passage from boyhood to manhood. Scholars have shown that this cultural belief continues to this day. Historical scholarship on Ottoman and Turkish manliness and masculinity has focused on two related themes. The first examines the myth of military nation was constructed and maintained during the Republic. This myth suggests that Turks have been a courageous military nation and every Turk is born a soldier from birth. The second trend has focused on paramilitary youth organizations created in 1912 and 1913, which were based largely on the Boy Scouts model. The paramilitary training was to create masculinized, militarized, and nationalized young boys ready to be turned into real men by military service. These boys needed to be strengthened with natural qualities of Turkishness, which meant, according to these very sources, manliness and bravery. Because the war started before these organizations turned out graduates, the task of turning boys into men occurred during military training and socialization. Using traditional notions of what it meant to be a man in a patriarchal society, motivational manuals confirmed them with some repurposing. In essence, the manly sentiments manuals imparted can be described as bravery, stoic endurance, suppression of sentiment, and forbearance of pain and hardship. One manual put it in this way, quote, "Courage means manliness. Soldiering means manliness. The dignity of manliness depends on one's ability to have forbearance in the face of all kinds of difficulties and to remain firm in purpose," end quote. If soldiering was a manly duty and it was what turned a boy into men, then what defined a soldier also defined a man. Similarly, since courage meant manliness, the lack of courage or cowardice also meant the opposite of manliness. While the motivational manuals constructed an image of men in opposition to women, with significant emphasis on man's roles as protectors and defenders, woman's role was not completely excluded. At least one manual included some exceptional women in active roles as well. One of them was Kara Fatma, or literally Black Fatma, that's Fatma is her name, who was supposed to have played an important role in the defense of the city of Erzurum in the Russo-Turkish War of 1877-1878. As the town was besieged, Kara Fatma helped the wounded. This is her role as woman. But at some point, the town's redoubt was captured by the enemy. Seizing the chance, Kara Fatma gathered the elderly and the children, armed them to fight. Thus saving the city, Kara Fatma became the female lion, this is in quotation, for the manual writer who asked, quote, "If a female Ottoman behaves like this, how would a male Ottoman behave?" End quote. Of course, the answer was ready too. Quote, "Like a male lion." Though it might seem otherwise, the story told about Kara Fatma does not threaten gender dichotomy, but reaffirms it. War was man's work, since one of their duties was to defend the namus, this is that term again, or the sexual honor of their womenfolk. The story was a reminder that the men had failed. A few words are in order about namus as well. Though sometimes translated as virtue, namus refers both to sexual integrity of female members of a family or a man's ability to provide and defend his house, his female relations in particular, against threat from the outside world. As good as the exceptional Kara Fatma was, men needed to be better. They needed to be courageous defenders, not only to protect the honor of their woman, but also to rescue the namus or honor of manliness away from transgressing woman. I hope these also make the point, right? So Ottoman Empire is not, this is not specific to the Ottoman Empire. Because the worst enemy of courage was fear, manuals offered simple strategies for dealing with fear at the front. One work reminded the soldiers that they must stand like a citadel in front of the enemy, for anything would prove one a coward. Going further, it added, quote, "Such a cowardly soldier would be detested even by his own mother," end quote. Fear was inexcusable for everyone, but it was, quote, "exceptionally shameful for soldiers," end quote. Fear, I also suggest, chipped away at their sense of manliness. Given that cowardliness equaled the lack of manliness, one might expect the manuals to offer specific advice on how to overcome fear. However, they have nothing original to say on this. One manual put it in the typically blunt way, quote, "When the fighting starts, throw off your fear. Be forbearing in the face of terrifying experiences of war," end quote. But how does one throw off fear? Once more, we encounter tawakkul as an antidote. When experiencing fear of death, the soldier needed to resign himself to God's will, and that's how he was to overcome fear. Again, rather than taking publicly circulating codes of manliness as evidence of behavior, as some scholarship does, I want to briefly look at how codes of manliness related to the emotional states and behavior of the front soldiers as reflected in personal narratives. If military service was what turned men, boys into men, then war experience was what tested that manliness. Mehmet Shevki, actually, I should have switched slides. While fighting in Galicia, this is in Romania, Ottomans sent a force of expeditionary force there, fighting against the Russians, was so overcome with fear under Russian artillery fire that he remembered being in and out of consciousness. Many others recorded extreme fear states, which led some to make predictions about their future, even if they wanted to be desperately wrong. Quote, one wrote, "I don't think I will be able to come out of here alive. Who knows where my grave will be," end quote. One subaltern who faithfully recorded his diary, numerous scenes of death and destruction in Gallipoli, always followed them with comments like, quote, "This scene unnerved me immensely," or "I cannot forget the horror of the scene," or "My emotional and nervous situation keeps getting worse." Here's another one, "I cannot stand it any longer," or lastly, "My heart is extremely bothered." Finally, at another similar scene of destruction, he recorded in his diary, in his own words, "I am nearly a coward." This officer was none other than Mehmet Fasih, the one who chastised the sergeant. What did Mehmet Fasih do? Yeah, he also turned to tawakkul for comfort, so he tells us. It is clear that as a form of mental self-protection to cope with constant anxiety, all evidence indicates that the remedy was brief, that is, the remedy provided by tawakkul. Thus, Mehmet Fasih, when he finally fell asleep in his underground dugout, while still nervous that it would collapse on him and bury him alive, which was a constant anxiety for a lot of people fighting underground, it was not because of due to comfort or feeling provided by tawakkul, but I argue sheer physical and mental exhaustion that finally caused him to fall asleep. In the long run, tawakkul might have even undermined the sense of manliness by denying the fighting men the control over their fate. Certainly, by revealing their powerlessness, it eroded all those things which defined them as men. Day by day, they became a little less courageous, a little less stoic, a little less able to express fear and emotion, and a little less able to forbear pain and hardship. I think my marker is there. You go. All right. It is difficult to determine the usefulness of tawakkul. In the case of Europe, historians have pointed out that fatalism had mixed results. While having some benefit for troop morale, it might have undermined the idea of sacrifice in the long run. The notion of sacrifice provided a means by which death in war was rendered less horrifying when seen as martyrdom. Some European scholars have argued that from a nationalist perspective, dying in war was a regenerative act that would give life to the nation. This precise idea was highlighted in an Ottoman journal in 1914. Quote, "We run to the fields of battle where we kill and we die. Fortunate is the nation and happy is the soldiers of that nation who willingly die in a manly manner for religion and fatherland, so that the nation may live," end quote. Personal narratives, especially diaries, of front soldiers provide a sober check on the hard-edged expectations of the motivational literature, or on the words of the likes of Abdullah Fevzi Efendi, who suggested that men must be indoctrinated with the notion of martyrdom while he chose the safety of being a battalion imam. Surely men fought for a variety of reasons. Some might have really come forward with the intention of becoming a martyr, like Nuri of Erzurum did. But others fought to remain alive so they could return to their homes. I could have ended there, but I have something brief I wanted to add. I started a talk with a story from a subaltern's diary about motivation, fear, and manliness also included. I would like to finish with another which evokes a powerful sense of what war might have done to the men who fought. This is from Falih Rifke, who's pictured there, and that's the cover of his book, who was based in the Palestine front during the war. And in fact, he didn't really have front soldiers experience. He was the aide-de-camp of the 4th Army commander. So he had a relatively easy life, but he witnessed what other people went through. He tells a moving story of the withdrawing of the Ottoman forces towards the end of the war as the remnants of the 4th Army arrived in an Anatolian train stop. So they were on a train. As men got off the train, he noticed many old men and women searching for their sons among the soldiers. One old woman attracted his attention because she's asking everyone who dares to look in her direction, quote, "Have you seen my Ahmed?" Ahmed being is the son, her son. Falih Rifke asks himself, quote, "Which Ahmed of the hundreds of thousands of Ahmeds sent to the front?" End quote. For Falih Rifke, Ahmed becomes the every soldier, so like the doughboy. And he asks himself, and this is a quotation here, "Was her Ahmed eaten up by lice, by water, scurvy sore, or typhus lice? Even if he escaped them all, if you see her Ahmed, you need to ask him this question. Did you see my Ahmed? No, none of us saw your Ahmed, but your Ahmed saw everything. He even saw the hell Allah could not describe even to Prophet Muhammad. We had lost Ahmed in a gamble." Thank you.
Sure, either one.
Holly?
Thank you. This was interesting. I had a couple of questions. First of all, I think it was my understanding that a lot of the officers in the Ottoman military were trained by Prussians. I seem to recall reading about this in the case of people like Ali Fuad and Mustafa Kemal, and in the case of the elite military training institutions, and that they were using a lot of also Prussian literature that was translated. And so, first of all, you know, to what extent is that the case that these manuals that you're looking at have some kind of provenance elsewhere, and what are the changes that get made when they're brought in? I seem to recall from Mango's biography of Mustafa Kemal that it, you know, and of course it's impossible to verify most anything of the apocryphal things that Mustafa Kemal supposedly said, but one thing that he supposedly said at Gallipoli when things were going very badly for his troops was, "I do not expect you to fight, I expect you to die."
Right.
And this kind of fits nowhere in the schematic that you've outlined, this kind of senseless yet sort of necessary move. And to what extent do you think, it becomes something that he becomes famous for that shows his particular maybe bravery, but if you are under him, it's hard to get motivated by such, or
right.
It's hard to imagine being motivated
right.
by that phrase. And so I was wondering if you could talk a bit about whether that might be true or whether it's sort of a post-war construction and it's more about Mustafa Kemal. And finally, I was wondering if there is any account being made in this literature for the technology that these people are facing and how different it is from the technologies they faced in the Balkan Wars, for example, and whether death becomes kind of scarier because it comes in different forms than what a lot of people are accustomed to when they think of warfare.
Okay. I'm going to run over here to go grab my pen so I can actually, before I forget the questions, I can write them down. I should have taken it with me. So I'll start with the first one. The higher ranks, and obviously Mustafa Kemal included in this, Enver Pasha, et cetera, it is true that many of them, if not trained in Germany, educated in Germany, they certainly were trained under the Prussian military model. Now, the people I'm examining, or at least whose manuals I'm using, are usually the sort of the lower ranks. So it is possible that some went to Germany for training, but they are certainly not that slightly older group of or high superior officers like Enver Pasha and Mustafa Kemal. There are also some older motivational manuals, and because of no last names, it's difficult to trace some of these authors to see whether they were trained in Germany, because sometimes the author is simply Ali. You know, I don't know who Ali is, that there's no way of tracing it, of course. These manuals are very interesting because you see all kinds of them. One of the ones I find useful, actually, at least the second half, the first half, and he admits it, the author, that he's read a lot of French and German literature on how to motivate soldiers. So what he's doing is taking some of those, translating them, because we see quotations from Napoleon, we see quotations from Bismarck and all kinds of other European generals or political leaders. But there is also significant local flavor, right? Anything that goes against Islam or traditional beliefs are excluded from this. But they think they can use some of the same ideas. This is why I think there is significant amount of overlap in terms of sacrifice, motivation, et cetera, in the motivational literature that we see in Europe. I haven't examined those separately to see how close they are. But the authors of these admit them when they are actually getting their ideas from Europe. And they're happy enough to acknowledge that. Now, having said that, other questions?
Oh, the Mustafa Kemal quote, die.
Yeah. Well, actually, I mean, I don't know what to make of that, because this is, as you said, this is something he said that's coded, you find it as a quotation in every piece of literature on Gallipoli. And I recently finished an article on the sort of the memory of the Battle of Gallipoli, sort of the Islamization of it, right? So I compared it to secular nationalist memory of the Battle of Gallipoli versus the Islamized version of it, right? So one side highlights the role of Mustafa Kemal, the other one says he wasn't even there. Right, a person is there or is not there. So, but one makes that argument, and all of those secular nationalist scholarship, every one of them, even when the article was not even about Mustafa Kemal, had this quotation. So, in a way, this tells us, I suppose, that at that moment, the order. I guess we have to see the context, right? Whether Mustafa Kemal would have said that in another. At another time, at another moment, is questionable. So the moment that he utters this is the moment when the battle could be lost as it's constructed in the nationalist scholarship, basically. That when, actually, I forgot his name already, I showed the gravesite. So those people who lie in those graves are the ones that he told them to go die, basically. And almost all of them did. So this is obviously shown in the nationalist scholarship as reflecting, one, his toughness, his leadership as military commander, but also soldiers' willingness to do what he told them to do. So in all sort of aspects, it represents, from that perspective, the commitment to the defense of the fatherland. Does that answer? And there was a technology, yes. So technology question is an important one. I'm trying to study this, actually, because especially, I mean, at all Ottoman fronts, but also in Gallipoli, there was definitely, Ottomans were the underdogs, technologically speaking. They didn't have the same kinds of weapons, and they certainly didn't have the abundance of, say, artillery shells, right? Memoirs are full of, for example, an artillery commander coming, talking to Mehmet Fasi. He says, today I can use only 8 shells. Meanwhile, while he's there for 20 minutes, they count maybe, you know, several hundred shells the enemy's firing. So technology, from the soldier's perspective, I think creates this sort of a different kind of a situation of fear. One of the things they fear the most, and this has nothing with technology, I mentioned the buried alive issue, which created all kinds of shell shock conditions or hysterical conditions. But this has to do with the technology, because what's causing it is, on the one hand, the artillery shells of the Navy, British Navy, which is significantly larger than that of the Ottomans. But at the same time, another thing that scares them the most is sort of an invention that's, I think they traced this to the ANZAC, so the Australian New Zealand Army Corps, since the trenches were so close to each other, at some places 20, 25 meters, right? So you can actually sort of throw grenades, and the other side sometimes had enough time to pick it up and throw it back. But it turns out the ANZACs invaded something. Ottoman sources call it the, I have to translate this, what's a good term? I guess they call it land torpedo. That's it. A torpedo is what you fire basically from ship to ship or from a submarine to a ship. And these really scare the Ottomans, and they can't match it because the enemy side can fire it and immediately ends up on the other side because its trajectory is such that, I mean, it, you know, I guess it can be adjusted. So what scares the Ottoman is both the technology, but also, especially on the ANZAC side, how quickly they come up with new ways of obviously inflicting damage on the Ottoman side. So these kinds of things, because unpredictable, and every time they encounter a new weapon, or the destructiveness, extended destructiveness of those weapons that the enemy has, I think causes certain kind of increased sense of, I should say, sort of fear reactions or anxiety among the Ottomans. But I haven't gotten into this enough to be able to say significantly more than that. But that's one of the things I'm exploring.
Thanks for that. I want to ask about invocations of historical memory as motivation. So for the German side, one of the interesting things is the constant reference, particularly for older professors, for their younger students, is the War of 1870, 69-70, the Franco-Prussian War. And it's interesting, of course, that many people have fought more recently. There are colonial wars and so on. But that's the one that everyone references, and the work it does is tremendous, right? That was the war that created our nation. Now it's 1914. This is the war that has an equally existential kind of role to play. And there's lots of work being done. So what is the equivalent conflict? Is there one that's being invoked? Why and what kinds of work are they trying to do with that particular historical reference?
I think what I cover this in my book. I have to answer it in this way. The nationalist narrative in the Turkish Republic, up until actually 1960s, 70s, pretty much ignored the First World War. Because there was an attempt to highlight the War of Independence, which started in 1919 and lasted until 1922. Maybe I overstated my dates a little bit. I mean, it certainly lasts that long, but there's also a bit of a sort of a highlighting of World War I as sort of an acceptable war that they could examine. The reason for this is not the Great War itself necessarily, but it happened that the Great War belonged with the Ottoman Empire, which the Turkish Republic rejected. When a new republic was founded in 1923, the Ottoman past became prehistory. So textbooks started with 1919, 1922, 1923. Later on, in the later 30s, they might have included some things about the Ottoman Empire, but very sort of limited, right? It's only there to highlight a few victories, but also show that starting in mid-16th century, this long decline started, lasted until 1922, right? And very brief. And most of it was to show how corrupt, how backwards, how traditional the Ottoman society was. Therefore, the Turkish Republic was modern, significant improvement, etc. So it had this role to play in the construction of Turkish identity as well. But World War I was also the war, the likes of Mustafa Kemal is obviously where he made his name. Of course, he's better known for the War of Independence in Turkey, but that's what happened. What happens also starting in the 1930s, along with the rejection of the Ottoman past, therefore World War I, is that there is a sort of selective inclusion of the First World War in the nationalist memory and narrative. So what they do is to take the Battle of Gallipoli alone, almost separated completely from the Great War, and turn it into a part of the War of Independence. Right? So books appear. Literature collections appear with the titles of examples of literature from the War of Independence. Open the cover, it starts with Gallipoli, right? So Gallipoli becomes a prototype of the War of Independence in this new nationalist narrative of the time period. Now, what's happening recently is that there's suddenly this increased interest in the Balkan Wars. There was no interest in it before. So it seems that depending on the political agendas of who's doing the research, who's becoming sort of interested in these kinds of topics, one thing is highlighted over the other. So now there are scholars, some legitimate, some sort of not so legitimate or popular historians, who are making the case that the Balkan Wars were actually more important for the Ottoman Empire than either the First World War and obviously the War of Independence for the Turkish Republic. So,
sorry, you went forward though. I was asking, in 1914, when people are trying to motivate soldiers to fight.
Oh, I see, okay.
What is, just like in 1914 for the Germans, they look back to 1870 and say, you've got a chance to do that again. In 1914 for the Turks, what is being invoked historically as the reference?
I misunderstood, okay. So there is both what to do in terms of what victory we should look at and also what not to do. So immediately literature appears after the Balkan Wars to recover what was lost. So how to avoid the mistakes of the Balkan War. But in terms of what wars are referenced, actually it goes back all the way to 16th century. And it's not a single war, it's various victories. So the idea is that we did this once, we can do it again, right? So most of them are wars fought during the reign of Suleiman the Magnificent, but also some earlier wars. So not a single one, but a number of them. That is, these are meant to basically, again, those historical lessons I mentioned, excite the spirits of the soldiers and to convince them that these were their ancestors who did it, and they can also do it, but not a single war that they point to.
What's the, following up on this in some ways, then already very early in the Republic, the model for you know, the Turks as a warrior nation becomes a Gazi ideal and strongly based on really pre-Ottoman or early Ottoman sort of models, Batal Gazi, whatever. I mean, these are sort of the great frontier warrior heroes. And that seemed to be largely absent from the account that you've been giving, that the golden age here of Ottoman military prowess is actually the height of expansion under Suleiman, and not a sort of heroic age calling back on early literary epics and things like this, where you point to a different set of models, which seems curious, because in some ways those figures are, even in the, you know, the early literature, not necessarily elites. There are models that you could call upon there for encouraging courage on the part of the common soldier that maybe aren't being drawn upon. Right. Or do those, is there a Gazi ideal in this motivation?
Yes, you do find them, actually. You also find, there's some reaction to this as representing the old school, right? So the newer ones want to avoid those the Gazi ethos, basically. And they want to talk about the wars of the 16th century, et cetera. But you also find frequent references to Ali, the caliph, right? Because of his military prowess, et cetera, then those sort of bastions of Sunni who come around and say, well, that's fine, it was a great warrior, but, you know, without necessarily spelling it out, they want to include more Sunni rather than people identified with Shia Islam, right? And there are also all kinds of stories that come from everything from Batal Ghazi, that's what you mentioned, right? And also other sort of heroes like that. But these are very brief, usually. These are the shortest of those pamphlets, usually 8 to 10 pages, whereas the more sophisticated ones, and I guess this is also what makes them more sophisticated, up to 100 pages or so, right? They seem to cover similar themes. Some are significantly more religious than others. It depends, you know, again, difficult to figure out who some of these people are, either men of religion or men of the military. But I think what they cover depends also on the background of those individuals as well.
You kind of covered a period that goes all the way from 1912 to 1920, more or less. It's a very big period in which the composition of the army changes drastically. I'm interested in the earlier period motivation, with the army being quite mixed, particularly the Arab element in Gallipoli, for instance, and the way the reference to the fatherland changes later on. Has it always been about the Turkish fatherland? If not, was it targeted based on which battalion you're fighting in? So if you're, because the Arabs would be in one battalion or in several battalions and the Turks, or like self-identifying Turks would be in different battalions. How did the fatherland concept change as it became more homogeneous?
Well, actually, this is the thing. It's not defined. And what they're trying to do is undo that regionalism, basically. So fatherland is what the borders happened to be, right? So when there are more Arabs, and there are plenty of Arabs in Gallipoli, actually, right? So fatherland is fatherland. But before World War I, in fact, it starts with the Balkan Wars, the fatherland idea, because there are also more non-Muslims in the Ottoman military at that time, around this time period. I think there was a little chart there, right? These are estimates, maybe about 9 or 10% non-Muslims in the Ottoman military. But in the Balkan Wars, significantly more. So this idea of fatherland versus defense of religion seems to be more important, or at least becomes the thing to highlight at that point. So in the War of Independence, so a little bit later, there's this idea of Misak and Mili, or the national borders, but by that time, it's a little late. So the idea still is, in order to encourage those Muslims who stayed inside the national borders, so Kurds, Circassians, etc. So it's not, again, ethnic, but this idea of borders of the remnants of the Ottoman Empire, which they are calling Turkey, but there's no ethnicity attached to it. So, but this is the thing, the fatherland is not defined. And the term is, another issue here is vatan, right? I chose to translate it as fatherland because the Arabic word is masculine for this. And in fact, in some of the manuals, fatherland is feminized as well. Right, so the nation and the fatherland is in order, in the interest of time, I remove some of this, that, you know, what happens if the enemy touches your fatherland, right? The idea is that it equals to rape, right? So the fatherland is feminized without being defined, again, what those borders are.
A couple questions, actually. So we've spoken a lot about one major aspect of war, which is fighting. I'm thinking of maybe other aspects of war in which masculinity might have played a role, particularly occupation. So I mean, at the very least, I mean, you showed some Ottoman troops in Galicia. The Central Powers occupy quite a bit of territory in Eastern Europe. Does the discourse of masculinity extend to the ways in which these territories were administered? And the other question is about sort of, when you have mass mobilization and mass conscription, what tends to happen is to fill the gap in the workforce, women need to play a greater role in the public sphere. Did this happen in the Ottoman Empire? And
no.
How?
Thanks for these questions. The first one, I have a quick but not a very good answer in the sense that I haven't explored it. But it's a very good question. And the second one, I haven't explored it yet, I should say. Relatively new project. This new project is. In the second one, sure, Ottoman women fill the workforce, but only to a very little extent. And it's not because there's anything standing in the way, but what's standing in the way is that Ottoman Empire was not an industrialized country. Or an empire, right? So women are conscripted as if they're soldiers, basically. And in fact, they call their work units women's labor battalions, right? They're treated as soldiers. They don't dress as soldiers. I mean, they have the headscarf and all this. They do everything from road construction, so some heavy labor, right? They are seams. They work in small factories to to create uniforms for. Men, they work in small sort of workshops, sometimes producing, refilling cartridges, etc., these kinds of things. But the numbers of them compared to European countries are very, very limited. And what happens is that when the war is over, that's it. So rather than, what happens in the US and in European countries, some women are able to keep their jobs, but in the Ottoman Empire, because I guess you could say the state disappears, right? And they feel that there's no need for this anymore. There's occupation, right? Also, men come back from the fronts, and there's already problems with employing them or finding them jobs, so women are simply, with the disappearance of the wartime government, they lose their jobs. But numbers, I don't know. They're very small, I know this. And they don't exist actually in rural parts of the country, so it's mostly Istanbul and a couple of other big cities. I think there's one in Izmir, Smyrna, but mostly in Istanbul and just very limited. There's been very little work done on this. I know somebody who might be working on it, because he writes to ask me for sources, and I just assumed that he was working on it, but the book hasn't come out yet. Thank you.